You're listening to The Hour of the Time, and I'm Michelle.
The heads are up, the chests are out, the arms are swinging and cadence count. Down low, one, two, down low, three, four, cadence count. One, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. I had a good home, but I left.
You're right.
You had a good home, but you left.
You're right.
Joni was there when I left.
You're right.
And Joni was there when you left. Sound low, one, two, sound low, three, four, ten counts, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo, let's go back and count some more. Sound low, one, two, sound low, three, four, ten counts, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's program is a salute to the patriotic music of America. That brief selection you just heard is from a very rare album. It was released in the 1950s by Childcraft Encyclopedia and is called Patriotic Songs and Marches for Children. I recently encountered a public school where the children no longer recite the Pledge of Allegiance at all. Twice a week, the principal reads the Pledge of Allegiance over the intercom into the classrooms, but the children are not encouraged to stand by the side of their desks, place their hand over their heart, and pledge the flag. This simply is not done. And I thought it would be appropriate, given the state of the nation today, to collect some of this wonderful patriotic American music and some of the stories about it in an episode of The Hour of the Time, if for no other reason than to make it available to our children later on so they can remember these things and appreciate our great musical heritage, which celebrates our freedom. I'd like to open this evening's program with a rousing rendition of Yankee Doodle. The irony of Yankee Doodle, the first great American popular song and still a popular favorite, is that it may have been conceived as a mockery of the American colonial soldiers. One of the most common legends about the tune attributes its authorship to a surgeon attached to the British Army at Albany during the French and Indian Wars, who was so bemused by the ragamuffin appearance of the colonial troops attached to his regiment that he composed this mocking little ditty sometime in the 1750s. It soon became a popular British taunt, and even the colonials took to singing it, not realizing that the joke was on them. Supposedly, when Colonel Hugh Percy's troops marched out of Boston in April 1775 on their way to Lexington and Concord, they kept step to the strains of Yankee Doodle. But the colonials had the last laugh. As the British beat a hasty retreat, the victorious Americans followed, singing a gleeful rendition of the tune. This arrangement is performed by the Boston Pops Orchestra. The close ties between Great Britain and the United States have long been strengthened by one unassailable link. God Save the Queen and America share the same tune. Though its melodic origins are obscure, by 1745, the British version had already become England's national anthem. Then it was God Save Great George, Our King. By the time of the Revolution, the colonists were making up all sorts of patriotic variations. God Save George Washington, Our 13 States, America. The words Americans sing today were written in 1831 by Samuel Francis Smith, a Boston minister, for a children's 4th of July celebration. composers or conductors have delved as deeply into the American idiom as Morton Gould. His brief symphonic work, American Salute, which he wrote in the early 1940s, is a brilliantly orchestrated version of the Civil War song When Johnny Comes Marching Home, one of the finest from our legacy of American popular airs. The tune is unusual in its minor quality, which gives a bittersweet tang to the martial phrases. Gould has accented the bittersweet by making it brilliant and accented the sardonic by making it snappy. The American Salute, a cross between a concert overture and a symphonic march, is in the form of a theme and variations, with the theme always recognizable and the mood always stirring. most modern-day listeners probably know American Patrol through the swing version by Glenn Miller and his orchestra that was first popularized in 1942. But the piece had been around for more than 50 years before the trombonist adapted it. Written for piano by Frank W. Meacham in 1885, it was soon orchestrated and became a favorite at concerts of the military bands so common around the turn of the century. One reason could well have been Meacham's inclusion of several familiar and beloved American themes, including Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean, Dixie, and Yankee Doodle in the fabric of the piece. After Miller's instrumental success with the tune, lyricist Edgar Leslie, who also wrote the words for Me and My Gal, Among My Souvenirs, and many other songs, added the words that turned it into the World War II work entitled We Must Be Vigilant. This is American Patrol.
Thank you.
Irving Berlin wrote God Bless America during World War I for Yip Yip Yaphank, an all-soldier show that he created at Camp Yaphank on Long Island, New York. But he cut it from the score because he didn't think it was appropriate for the scene in which it was to be sung. It lay neglected in his songwriter's trunk for 20 years until Kate Smith, planning a radio program for Armistice Day, asked him to write a new patriotic song for her. Berlin tried, but was unhappy with all of his efforts. Then he remembered the song he had written in 1918. Kate sang it on the radio for the first time on November the 10th, 1938, and it met with overwhelming enthusiasm. The following year, Berlin assigned all of the royalties to the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America, proceeds they continue to receive today. His reason? He didn't want to capitalize on this expression of gratitude that he, as an immigrant, felt for the United States. This is God Bless America, sung by Kate Smith. As the Austrian composer Johann Strauss, Jr. is called the Waltz King, so, and for equal reason, is America's own John Philip Sousa known as the March King. And if any one march offers explanation for that title, it must surely be his masterpiece, The Stars and Stripes Forever. Sousa composed it while returning by ship from Europe, swept up in a surge of patriotic nostalgia, and guided, he said, by divine inspiration. The three themes of the final trio were meant to typify the three sections of the United States. The broad melody, or main theme, represents the North. The famous piccolo obbligato is the South, and the bold countermelody of the trombones recalls the West. Sousa penned the piece on Christmas Day, 1896, presumably in his hotel suite in New York after the boat had docked. For all of its salty flavor and the images it conjures up of an American battle fleet slicing through surging waves, the stirring march, Anchors Away, was actually composed for a football game, although a naval one at that, and for 20 years was associated only with football. The game was the 1906 Army-Navy encounter, and the composer was Charles A. Zimmerman, the musical director of the Naval Academy. The lyricist was Alfred H. Miles, a member of the Academy's class of 1907. In 1926, the year the song was officially adopted by the Navy, another midshipman, Royal Lovell, wrote additional words for it. This is Anchors Away for the U.S. Navy.
Oh!
For a number of years, John Philip Sousa was widely thought to have composed The Caissons Go Rolling Along, a tribute to the artillerymen who hit the dusty trail as the caissons go rolling along. The attribution was due to the publication in 1918 of the U.S. Field Artillery March, listing the March King as composer. Actually, Sousa's version was only an arrangement of a march that had been composed 11 years earlier by Edmund L. Gruber, a career army officer, for a reunion in the Philippine Islands of two long-separated units of the 5th Field Artillery Regiment. A post-World War II adaptation turned Gruber's tune into The Army Goes Rolling Along, which was subsequently designated the official song of the United States Army. Possibly the most surprising revelation in all march literature is that Jacques Offenbach, who first put the champagne bubbles into Parisian comic opera, was responsible for the music of the Marines Hymn. Of course, Offenbach didn't call it that when he wrote it for an operetta entitled Janvier du Brabant. Apparently around 1918, an operetta-loving leatherneck put the tune and its now familiar words saluting the United States Marines together. The two references in the opening lines are to Marine victories. The Halls of Montezuma celebrates the Mexican War of 1846 to 1848, and the Shores of Tripoli refers to the four-year military action against North African Barbary pirates that ended in 1805. Easily the most recent of the classic United States military songs is one that was known to every child growing up in America during World War II as Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder. It was written in 1939 by Robert M. Crawford, a member of the music faculty at Princeton, for a contest sponsored by Liberty Magazine to find a song for the newly formed Army Air Corps, and was known at that time as the Army Air Corps Song. In accordance with the changes the years have brought, the song and the Corps are now known as the U.S. Air Force. Thank you. Although she had been to Europe many times, Catherine Lee Bates, a professor at Wellesley College in Massachusetts, had never seen much of her native country. So in 1893, she attended the Columbian Exposition in Chicago and then traveled on to Colorado Springs. One day, she ventured to the top of nearby Pike's Peak. She was overcome by the view from the summit, and that night wrote the first draft of a poem, America the Beautiful. It was published 2 years later in a magazine called The Congregationalist. In 1913, her poem was set to music, to a melody written in the 1880s by one Samuel A. Ward of Newark, New Jersey, for the hymn, O Mother, Dear Jerusalem. So stirring and popular was the resulting song that it was serious competition for the Star-Spangled Banner when a national anthem was finally selected in 1931. This is America the Beautiful. On the morning of September 13, 1814, during the War of 1812, Francis Scott Key boarded a British warship in Chesapeake Bay under a flag of truce. His mission was to secure the release of a civilian taken prisoner during the British evacuation of Washington, D.C. But once aboard, he was unable to leave because the fleet had begun its attack on Fort McHenry. When the smoke had cleared the following morning, Key looked at the fort to discover that it had not surrendered. He began scribbling a poem and completed it by the time he got to shore. Sung to an English drinking song, to Anna Creon in Heaven, his poem became popular immediately, although the Star Spangled Banner didn't become our national anthem until more than a century later, in 1931. Your homework assignment is to find a book of English literature and locate the third stanza of the Star Spangled Banner written by Francis Scott Key, for we only sing three stanzas of his poem in our national anthem, and he wrote four. This is our national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner.
Thank you.
Battle Hymn of the Republic. Julia Ward Howe wrote the words for this stirring tune during the Civil War in the process of creating one of the most enduring of patriotic songs. She had heard the melody sung by Union soldiers in Washington, D.C. one day in 1861. The tune was drawn from an old Methodist hymn, possibly written by one John William Steffi, and originally titled, "Say, Brothers, Will You Meet Us?" The soldiers were singing words called "John Brown's Body," probably thinking the song referred to the militant anti-slavery leader who staged the famous raid at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. The John Brown referred to was actually an Army sergeant stationed at a fort in Massachusetts. The Atlantic Monthly published Mrs. Howe's lyric, paying her $5, and history took care of the rest. We will join the Battle Hymn of the Republic in progress, taking us up to the top of the hour. And may God bless each and every one of you, and God bless our Republic.